This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the May 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Transect by Kim Stanley Robinson. After he had secured a window seat in the Amtrak coach, he set his dark brown leather briefcase in his lap and unlocked it. Clunk, clunk. He liked the way the gold-plated hasps snapped open, about 50 times more power in the springs than was necessary, sign of a well-tooled briefcase. Big, heavy, powerful, expensive, something for clients to note with approval. Part of their confidence in him. Riffling through his account files was depressing. Nothing in there but bad news. No one was buying fine paper in quantity these days. He had to bust a gut just to stay even. Northeast Section Marketing and Sales Vice President, forever and ever, amen. He sighed. At times like this, he felt utterly stuck. No chance of advancement whatsoever. Stuck at $45,000 a year for good, and with wife and kids throwing it away faster than he could make it. Lucky his credit was good. He could spend his future right up to his death and beyond, no doubt. Ah, the end of a long, hard trip. He needed a drink. The train came out of its hole, and he looked into the industrial yards of Montreal. Beyond them was the city center where he had spent the day selling, sun setting behind it. Funny how much Canada looked like the States, he always thought that. He let his files accordion back into the briefcase and pulled out his copy of the day's Wall Street Journal. Up and down the train car, other copies of the same paper were blooming over the plush maroon seats covering the businessmen behind them. A young punk, wearing earphones, sat in the aisle seat beside him, cramping his reading. Faint whispers of percussive music joined the rustling of newspapers in the strangely hushed car. Nothing in the day's journal was of interest. He folded it and put it in his lap. They were out of the industrial district, in the trees between suburbs. Too late in the fall. The half-bare trees looked bedraggled, the leaf-matted ground wet and boggy. He folded his suit jacket over twice and used it as a pillow against the inner window. It would have to be dry-cleaned anyway. He had spilled a few drops of burgundy on it at lunch, right on top of the right cuff, where clients would see it when he signed things. "Hey, Brover, watch out where you're going when you're walking backwards like that. Here. You need a hand with those?" "Thanks, I got them." He heaved up on the straps tied around his two boxes and pulled them past the old man down the center of the train. The benches on both sides were crowded with migrant workers going home, jammed together hip to hip. Their boxes and bags were stacked on the wooden floor, leaving him just enough room to maneuver to the end of the car. There, because it was the last car on the train, he could set his two boxes in the middle of the aisle and sit on them, as several other men had already done. He greeted them with a full lift of his chin. "Where are you from, Broder?"
"Mis amplés hostels. I did my 11 months there, now I going home. Home to Qua Chosa."
"Home," said a thin colored man bitterly. "Just how is Qua Chosa Bantayan your home?"
"My folks is there," he said with a shrug. "Your folks is there because the government moved them there," the man said. "Me, my home is Robben Island. It been my home 9 years and all because of one night's ANC meeting at my house. They gave me 2.5 years for taking subscriptions, 1.5 years for meeting, and 5 years for distributing pamphlets all the same night." He laughed harshly. "Now I'm out and they ban me. Clearly I must be meeting a whole bunch of communists in those 9 years, for they ban me the moment I out. Ban me to Qua Chosa, where I never been in my whole life, where I can never see my family for 5 long years. The others laughed their sympathy. Ah, that's too bad, Pieter. You got to watch all those bad phone calls you make from the island, man. The conversation focused on the newcomer. What's your name? Norman. What did you do in Soweto? Bricklayer, Norman said. The train jerked twice and they rolled out of Park Station. That against the law, you know, Pieter said. If they pay attention to their own law, you could not have job. Nee Kaffir bricklayers, nee. This with the heavy Afrikaner tone. The men laughed. Several in the car turned on transistor radios and the hard rhythms clashed. The train cleared the outskirts of Johannesburg and clattered through the outlying townships. Norman looked out the window and saw 3 women sitting on a step, leaning in on each other in a stupor, empty bottles, blank faces under the streetlight. He recognized in the slump of their shoulders that moment of exhaustion and peace, and felt his own shoulders relax with it. He was on his way home. The train swayed as it took a sharp turn, one last view of Montreal. He put his suit jacket on the chair arm and pulled a Sherman cigarette from the box in his briefcase. The punk next to him appeared to be asleep, although faint music still whispered from his earphones. He lit the Sherman with the gold lighter his boss had given him and felt a certain uneasiness leave him breath by breath. Hard to sleep on a train. Another station stop. The people in his car were mostly commuters. Briefcases, cufflinks, polished shoes, the swish-swish of nyloned legs rubbing together. His head shifted so he could see the tight dress between the 2 seatbacks in front of him. She sat 2 seats ahead. A man with a cough sat behind him. Muted voices came from the car behind theirs until a door hissed shut. When the Sherman was finished, he took a last look at the nightlights of Montreal. The company's awards dinner had been in Montreal just a month earlier, in the fashionable district downtown. He had expected to win the regional sales award for the year, because things were tough everywhere, and he did have some big, regular clientele. He took his wife along. All that backslapping and joking about the awards at the cocktail party before, as if no one cared about them, as if they were bowling trophies or something, when everyone knew they were a strong indicator of what the upper echelon thought of your prospects. So that in that sense, they represented thousands of dollars, careers even. So that looking around the room, there was a part of him that hated all his colleagues, his competitors, even more so afterwards when he had to do like all the rest and go up to congratulate the winner, George Dulac, head of the Midwestern section, which in itself was an advantage. Beaming winner surrounded by envious admirers, shiny gold pen set cradled in one hand. Finally, he had gone away to get a drink. It was just like management to make the work a contest like this, to get them all at each other's throats. Competition more productive than teamwork, the American way. On Robben Island, Pieter said, the Ag Turnier is the one the warden uses to control the rest. He, the guard, inside, and gets the little extras, you know, tobacco and such. But our Agternier was not a bad man. He help us, get us food sometimes, and one night we was entertaining one another. Sally, he acting out the various guards and the wardens, all without one word, you see, but just watching him, we knew exactly who he mean, and we giggling and brushing, we never clapped, you see, for fear of the guard's attentions. So to applaud, we rubbed our hands together like so. They heard nothing of Pieter's risen applause over the talk and the radios, and we in such a state, we never in the world hear the guard coming, but for the Ag Turnier sitting in the cement at the door watching for them. He'd been standing watch for us all those nights and never let us know till he had to. He laughed. A good man. I've been living in a prison, too, these last 11 months, Norman said suddenly, surprising them all, including himself. A prison called the Mizimlop Hostels. Most of them had been living around Soweto in the men's dormitories that housed the migrant laborers from the Bantustans, and some said, "We hear that, Broer." But Pieter quickly disagreed. "Nothing's prison but prison, man," and continued telling stories of Robben Island. Norman was not listening to Pieter anymore. However, he was back in the hostels looking after row after row after row of low gray dorms, their chimneys jutting out of asbestos roofs into the sky. One morning, after a Friday night's drinking, he had gotten up and stumbled out of the dorm to the toilets in the next building. In the door, past the cement troughs for washing dishes and clothes, to the open toilet basins, there to retch miserably. As he returned to his dorm, he felt so sick he was sure he would die before his 11-month stint of work in Soweto was up. That certainty gave him new eyes as he entered the dorm and crossed the dusty concrete floor. Past the low concrete slabs on metal struts that were their tables, past the benches, also made of concrete slabs, to the sleeping cubicles where men slept on the door-like lids of their brick trunks that held all their possessions. In the gloom, it seemed they slept on coffins. Beyond, in the kitchen cubicle, men were still playing guitars connected to little amplifiers, and the low electric twangs were the only signs that the men sitting around the small stove were still awake, still alive, a single candle on the slab beside them, shadows everywhere in the dim air, drying shirts hung overhead, and bitterly he thought, what a place to die in. Perhaps he would get a drink. The restaurant car was only two ahead, and he was thirsty and needed to wash down some aspirin. He needed a drink. He stood and managed to step over the sleeping punk, debated taking the briefcase with him, but after all, it was locked and no one was going anywhere anyway. Hopefully, by his presence, the punk would guard it. Down the car, his balance was shaky. Something wrong with him this night. He should have gotten a sleeper. Too much pride in his endurance as a traveler. One of the soundproofed compartment and into the cold, jouncing passageway between cars. Here, you could believe the train was really moving. Back into the hush of the next car. Only half the overhead lights were still on here, and most of the occupants were asleep. Some read or listened to earphones. Half their heads were shaved or tinted green or purple, it seemed. Craziness. His daughter, only 14 years old, had brought one of those home once. He hadn't known how to express his disgust. He left it to Vicky, tried to forget about it. There was a line at the little bar in the restaurant car. The two black bartenders went at the work casually, chatting to each other about vacationing in Jamaica, just as if there weren't a line. When one of them asked him what he wanted, he curtly ordered a gin and tonic and a foil bag of nuts, but his disapproval didn't seem to register. He sipped the gin and tonic, a weak one, to give himself some room for jiggling while he walked, then saw that the woman in the tight dress was sitting at one of the little tables. He sat at another and watched her as he drank, not actually very good looking. When he finished the drink, it felt like a million miles separated him from everyone else there. He stood and returned to his seat. Should have gotten a sleeper. Something wrong with him, some kind of tension somehow. Had to avoid that kind of thing or it was back to the Tagamet for him. Back in his seat, he stared through his reflection in the window at the world outside, clanking red lights at railroad crossings time after time, a sleeping town, even the neon off, loading docks, laundromat, village video rental. You saw a lot of those video places these days, even in the little backwoods towns. Movies in the privacy of your own home, and then it was gone. The drink began to go to his head, and the repeated hoot of the train's horn, so distant, so muted, was like the cry of some mournful beast, lulling him toward sleep and then calling him back time and again. The beauty of the Witwatersrand took his breath away. He had forgotten that such open, clean land existed in South Africa, and at the sight of it, something in his chest hurt. White clouds sprawled across a cobalt sky, and there, in the yellow woods and camdaboo stinkwoods dotting the sere grass of the veldt, flew locries, doves, hopo, and drongos with small white hawks circling far above. Wild gardens growing by the tracks. It affected all the men similarly, and they threw open the windows and laughed and shouted at the sky, aware, suddenly, that they really were going home. They danced in the aisle to the fast Mbanga beat and sang American spirituals, accompanied by a 15-year-old boy playing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot on the harmonica for all he was worth. It was grand. Then the train pulled into Vereeniging Sing Station. Still, in a celebratory mood, the men stuck their heads out the train window and shouted for the platform hawkers. "Dresses and aprons for your loved ones at only 5 rand, Brouwers." "Not a chance, sister. You bore me with your dresses. Let that beer man through to us." They bought dumpies of deer at an extortionate price and downed most of them before the train rattled off again. Then, through the outskirts of town, corrugated iron, donkeys, pigs, children, Indian corner groceries, pawpaw trees, women with washtubs, prickly pears, and scraps of paper everywhere, all over the hard-packed earth of the streets. "Oh, how I hate this town, the most hateful town in the world to me," one man cried. "My wife got off the train at this station, and I never saw her again up to this very day." The men whooped their sympathy. "Wasn't that Georgiana the hippo left you, man? She found you were undermining her interest with that girl in Joburg, didn't she? You lucky you didn't see snakes but that day instead." And the men laughed, he, as he shook his head to deny them. The man in the seat behind him could not stop coughing. A couple minutes labored breathing, the strained efforts to control it, then he couldn't believe it. Next time he thought, "I'll drive. To hell with this." His throat was beginning to tickle a little, right there below his Adam's apple, and briefly he glanced over his shoulder in irritation. Old, pasty-faced man with dark rings under his eyes in a shabby gray suit, Italian-looking. Incredibly inconsiderate of him to travel sick and infect everyone else on the train. He really was coming down with it. He swallowed over and over. There was only a single light on in the car. Some insomniac businessman reading In Search of Excellence, still looking fresh and unruffled at 2 a.m. "Yeah, you'll win the award," he thought angrily, "and me, I'll just catch a cold, and all because of the luck of seating availability." He hated being sick. You couldn't possibly make a good impression with a cold. Sales out of the question. Might as well stay at home and watch Vicky take care of things. More coughs. It was enough to make him envy the sleeping punk his earphones, although that would still be no protection for his throat. Abruptly, he stood and took a walk towards the restaurant car. It was closed for the night. Back between cars in the cold passageway, He noticed that the train was moving very slowly. He looked through the thick little window in the passenger door. They were over water. Lake Champlain, he guessed. The railroad bridge was so old and rickety that the train had to cross at about 10 miles an hour. Looking down, he couldn't even see the bridge, it was so narrow. White mist lay over the water, swirling eerily under the half moon. He shivered convulsively. Something odd about this night. The hush too quiet, the distances too great. He must be getting ill, or something. For the last few years, he had gotten his life into such a groove, such a routine of day-to-day activities, each day resembling its predecessor from the week before, Mondays all alike, Fridays all alike, Saturdays, that he had found himself with time on his hands. It seemed he could live his life on a sort of automatic pilot, leaving him all sorts of time to just think, like he really never had before. And once or twice in this new thinking, he had wondered what it being his life, the world, everything, was all about. No great answer had jumped immediately to mind. Often he was left with just this sort of uneasy feeling. Out there, was that another train? No, just mist, a lake of white cotton. Nothing for it but to return to his seat. As the night progressed, he fell in and out of a half-sleep that resembled a trance. Several times they stopped at stations briefly, and once he woke completely when the police boarded to check everyone's passbooks. Two big white security police making an old black ticket taker do most of the work. The migrants dug through their possessions for their reference books, tins, boxes, old water drums bound with straps, all heavily loaded with basic groceries to help out the families on the Bantu stands. Norman's boxes were full of sugar, salt, and tea, all packed under his extra shirt and pants. His passbook was in the spare shirt's pocket. He pulled it out and bent the corners back down. All the stamps were in order, and he gave the ticket taker the book without looking up. Out the windowless Cape Fig trees shaded the tiny Velt station, flanking the tracks like a hedge. Signs marked the entrances to the station house. Blancs? Knee blocks. One of the security police took Pieter's passbook from the ticket taker's hand and inspected it closely. Suddenly, no one in the car was talking. The radios babbled in Zulu and Xhosa. Then the policeman showed it to his companion and laughed. Robin vir qua Xhosa. Di lu is swar, ne, Pieter? Ja, my boss, Pieter said, looking at the floor of the corridor. Life is hard, all right. Listen to me, Siontji, the policeman said, and gave Pieter a little lecture. More God, Volk, and Trek, as someone said when they were gone. Pieter resolutely stared at the floor. When the policeman finished, Pieter looked up at him, the hatred clear in his eyes. My stamps are good, ja, boss? Ja, Siontje, the big man said easily and tossed Pieter his passbook. The two police led the ticket taker out of the car, laughing over something, the pass checks already forgotten. Cape Town whores are best. Mooring Kaffirs will kill you in bed, though. When they were gone and everyone started breathing properly again, only now could they be sure that all the passbooks were really in order. Often they were not, and so one didn't discuss the matter. There had been a good chance someone on the car would be dragged off to jail, but they were all legal this time, and the talk began again. They stick him on the 10th floor by the open window, you know, but he refused the jump, and so he in jail and his kids is starving with hunger. You ever try sharing a bed with such a hippo? You got to sleep like a flea, ready to jump quick, and the fatter she got, the worse her temper. Man, I kissed Mother Earth daily living with her. Ha! Ha, she ransacked me good sometime. Yeah, and if you get up, it's up to the Labor Bureau like me to sell yourself off to the coal mines of Whitbank 1,000 miles from home. We had a bad one at our Labor Bureau. He says, which of you boys wants a job? And of course we all jumping up and down like dogs. Pick me, boss, pick me. And he picked one after another to tell them, no, they not good enough. Then he picked and looked through my workbook. Won't your wife sleep around while you gone, boy? I bet she sleep with me for giving you this job until he tire of the game and give me the joy of 11 months' work away from my folks. And that better still than prison, Pieter took it up, but Norman turned from Pieter's bitter comedies and looked out the window. Train nosing out of the station with hard jerks, as if the engine were yanking on it. An old man sitting in the dirt by a wheelbarrow, stacked with baskets, too late in the day to sell anymore, but still he sat in that twilight moment, slegs blancs. He got up to go to the bathroom, feeling distant, disoriented. Stepping over the punk was getting easy. The kid was slumped lower every time. Once again, troubled with balance. Something was wrong. Everything too hushed, almost silent, like cotton in his ears. Everything a great distance away. The bathroom at the front of the car was occupied. He turned and went to the car behind, the last one of the train. Maneuvered through all the tight turns and heavy, narrow doors between cars, found an empty bathroom for the disabled, but he used it anyway. Not exclusively for the disabled, right? Down the iron toilet, he could see the track ties flashing beneath the train. When he was done, he looked at himself in the cracked coppery mirror, hair mussed, face stubbly, some odd disquiet in his eyes. The beer wanted out of him, and he stood up to use the lavatory at the end of the next car up. By now, the travelers were drowsy with beer and fatigue, and he had to step over men sleeping in the aisles. Somehow, they sprawled in a way that always left footing just where it was needed. Outside in the dusk, the hillocks bordering the Orange River were etched against a moonless blue sky. Igkili River, he said to himself, mother of my country, Azania. He stepped through the doorway into the connecting corridor, over the shifting joints of the iron floor. The joints squealed loudly, and looking down at them, he almost ran into the man coming his way, a white from one of the first-class cars. Confused, he said, sorry, boss. The black kid muttered something under his breath so sullenly that he was suddenly afraid he might be mugged right there between the two cars. The wheels rolling over the track were loud. No one would hear him. Sorry about that, he said hastily, feeling dizzy, and yielded to the right. The train jerked and they bumped together hard. The black man reached out a hand to hold him steady, then withdrew as if shocked, his frightened eyes round and white in the gloom. Their gazes met and held. The look, dark brown iris, the whites a bit yellowed, pale blue iris, the whites a bit bloodshot, and the pupils identical round black holes, the windows of the soul through which one can fall, spinning dizzily to land cut, confused, stunned in a new place, and all with a look. He wasn't sure how long the kid's feral stare had held him still when he jerked free and pulled himself, staggering slightly, away. The doors were heavy and had to be pulled into the walls to right and left. Back in his car, the hush seemed more pronounced than ever. Unsteadily, he stepped back over the sleeping punk, feeling utterly shaken. The plush maroon velvet of his seat arm, silvery ashtray sliding in and out of the arm, long brown cigarette butts wasted inside. Looking around, such incredible, excessive luxury, and this was just a train. He stared. The migrant swayed with the train like luggage as he made his way in some confusion back to his boxes. Smell of sweat, beer, the hot Velp night. He ended the dwell on his boxes and looked at his companions. Their clothes were frayed and dirty. Their shoes were broken and full of holes. They slept or slumped in stupors of non-thought, and suddenly it seemed he could read what pain had chiseled in each worn face. The boy still hummed thoughtfully into his harmonica, bleak, falling chords. Finally, they slid into the labyrinth of Penn Station, darkness, trains passing by, their lit windows making them look like submarines, then track lights everywhere. The punk woke and stood up, everyone standing, stretching. He put his coat on in the aisle, feeling its smooth texture. The sick man was struggling to get his suitcase off the overhead racks, and awkwardly he helped him get it down. A haggard smile for thanks, he nodded quickly, embarrassed. Oppressive people. He held his briefcase close by his side, and he was out of the train, onto the long, crowded platform, up a set of stairs, turn and follow everyone else to the next set, up again into the light and glare of Penn Station's big central waiting area, with the businessmen and the students and the cops and the cleaning men and the bums. And then suddenly his wife was upon him with a quick hug and kiss, strong scent of perfume. She laughed at his exhaustion and held his arm as they made their way up to the street, chattering over something or other, and pleased that she had found a legal spot to park their car. She drove, and he sat back in the deep seat and looked at the bright dashboard, at her, glossy cap of blonde hair, blush on her cheeks like two bruises, upper eyelids blue, purple, lashes spiky black. He thought, she's mine. This is mine. I'm safe. At a red light, she glanced over at him and laughed again, lips dark red, teeth perfectly white and quick, leaned over to steady themselves as the old train clattered up the grade and out of the hills. Night passed, dawn arrived. They were in Qua Chosa now, and it was as if S.A. Railways had been a time machine, taking a century into the past overnight. Women they passed wore white turbans and led donkeys on dirt paths. On the plains before the blue mountains on the horizon were villages of circular, thatched rondeaus, whitewashed under the thatch and around the doors. Finally, the train clanked into Nenigobo, past some men on donkeys and around the last curve to the small wooden building and platform that served as the train station. As the train rolled in, all the men stuck their heads out the windows on the right to look, but under the harsh morning light, they saw that the station platform stood deserted, white, splintered, dusty planks, utterly empty in the sun. Not a single soul was there to greet them. And Thabo said to me, so many had gone and come back, and so many had gone and never come back again, that no one waited anymore. We continue with a story from the March 1986 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Dog of Truth by Kit Reed. In the juvenescence of the year, she thought moodily, came Christ the tiger. And what do I get? I get this stupid animal. It depressed her specifically because, except for the eyes, it was a ratty-looking creature. It wasn't even a jungle animal that crouched on the Morris chair regarding her. It was a dog. They had been together for 4 days, the two of them, Ever since the thing manifested itself in the middle of the decent period of mourning, she had declared, after she broke up with Alex. 4 whole days, she thought, and she still didn't know how she felt about it. Creepy, that's how. Those eyes. She'd been slumped in that very Morris chair in a welter of cookie boxes and candy wrappers, well on the way to becoming a truly fat person when she first saw it. At first, it was no more than an intimation of light, a suggestion flowing on the floor under the daybed, something glimmering faintly from underneath the dust ruffle. Depressed as she was, slightly addled by a surfeit of carbohydrates and weeping, she took it to be a figment of her imagination and turned her head so she wouldn't have to see it. When she woke, sometime after sunset, the room was dark and it was still there. She chose to believe it was only a hallucination. What else could it be? But when morning came and it was still there, she realized that she was going to have to reckon with it. She thought it might be an act of retribution, some unkindness designed by Alex. Maybe he had trapped lightning bugs in a jar and sneaked them in here while she wasn't looking. But how could he have done it? She'd been here ever since they broke up, day and night, wallowing in Malamars and Scuppermung wine. She supposed it could be light leaking out of the electrical outlet underneath the daybed, but that was crazy. What was it then? It was noon before she could bring herself to get close enough to investigate, and it took more nerve than she realized she had for her to lift the dust ruffle. To her surprise, there was something living underneath, a dog. At least, she guessed it was a dog. The glow came from its eyes, which were chartreuse. If animals smile, the thing was definitely smiling. "Who are you?" she asked it, "and what are you doing under there?" Her voice spiked because, smiling or not, the apparition was alarming. "Your mother sent me," it said reassuringly. She found this even more alarming. She had never expected the thing to talk, yet here they were, and it cocked its head in the dimly lit space underneath the daybed, waiting for her to answer it. "Mother." Her sigh was not altogether friendly. "I should have known. But why you, and why now?" She said, although you never tell her anything, a mother always knows these things. "What things?" "You know, that you've screwed up again." "The bitch." It sniffed sulkily. "I'm only telling you what she said." "But a dog, when she knows I think animals are creepy." The eyes glowed a little brighter. "You might as well know up front I'm not only an animal." All her anger at Alex had somehow become focused now on this implacable creature incandescing under the daybed, lighting up all her dust kittens and a pair of socks Alex had abandoned there like a silent reproach the first night she made him sleep on the sofa. But she was thinking about the animal. It was clearly uncomfortable under there, with its back rubbed up against her bed springs, but as she understood it, the thing was a gift from her mother, which put it in the category of things she might write thank yous for, but would never really accept. As a result, she could barely bring herself to speak to it. She would not have it, she thought. First Alex, then her losing her job because she'd been too depressed to go to work next day, which happened to be the day of a major meeting, which was how she happened to get fired on top of losing Alex, and now this. "I'm not only an animal," it had said. She would show it a thing or two. She sniffed and dropped the dust ruffle. The glow seemed to be stronger. Reluctantly, she lifted it again. The thing had not moved. "Well, are you going to invite me out or what?" "Come ahead," she said grudgingly. "You might as well. I haven't had a living soul to speak to since it all came down on me." Not exactly a living soul. Oh, come on, give me a break. Seen in full daylight, it was not half bad looking. It had a rough coat like the best terriers and a muzzle that made it look like a cross between a jungle beast and a teddy bear she had once owned. It took to the can of corned beef hash she had opened for it with a grin of gratitude, and once it had finished, got busy around the apartment, nosing throw rugs back in place and taking candy wrappers and discarded notes from Alex and several days' worth of newspapers in its teeth and putting them in the trash. While it was busy thus, she washed her hair and put on something flattering. It seemed like the least she could do. Then she came back into the living room. "This is terrific. Everything looks wonderful." It bridled modestly. "It seemed like the least I could do." With her hair clean and her face looking decent, she could afford to be generous. Under the circumstances, you understand it isn't you that makes me nervous. I mean you personally. It's where you came from. Translated, this meant that it was a gift from her mother, who was not a favorite person, but it misread her. "I come from beyond," it said modestly. "You've got to be kidding." "No, really. I was drifting out there the way we all do when I got the call. Urgent message. Come right down. Help you to attend to things. You know, good person in big trouble." "But I'm just fine." The thing's eyes went from chartreuse to telly green, and she reconsidered. "Okay, you came to the right place. I'm feeling shitty and everything is lousy." Without sounding the least bit smug, it said, "Exactly, which is what I'm doing here. Let me introduce myself. On second thought, you first." It made a little bow. "Amanda," she said self-consciously, "Amanda Springer." "What a nice name. No, I mean really. And I," the glow from the eyes was both paler and strangely a brighter color. "I am the dog of truth," it said into a silence that seemed to construct itself just to receive the information. "Now, what can I do for you?" She suppressed the first answer that came to her. Of course she didn't want Alex back. She was too smart to need any man. Too witty, too. Successful? Not lately. "I think I want my job back." It seemed to be saying, "So I understand. Now tell me what you want, really." "Just when we were getting along so well, my job back is what I most want, really." It just glimmered. She acknowledged this with a sigh of what might have been recognition. "All right, I don't know what I want." Which was how she ended up dropping several hundred dollars in a Midtown boutique and learned once and for all, and for the first time, how to dress for success. The dog of truth had somehow become small enough to fit into a small canvas tote bag, which meant it went with her into the shop and into the dressing room, where it passed on every stitch she tried. This dress was too pastel, that one too tartish. The green one would make them all turn up their toes and die, just right. When she came out, she was gorgeous. "It's your fault," she said, putting away her MasterCard. "I spent every cent I have coming from unemployment." From inside the tote bag, it coughed politely. Okay, it's not your fault. I wanted to spend every cent. Now what?" If dogs could be said to purr, the animal was purring. "Let's have lunch." At lunch, it slid out of the bag and assumed normal size so it could perch opposite her at a table in a sidewalk cafe. Nobody seemed to notice it, and arresting as the thing was, it did not attract even a glance from passers-by. Instead, the two of them ate more or less in silence, munching on chocolate croissants with a particularly nice triple creme fraiche. We're going to get fat, Amanda corrected herself quickly. I mean, I am. She supposed this was how, after her unannounced appearance at the office, she ended up changing out of her drop-dead Dress for Success ensemble and running around the reservoir. She was going to have to keep trim if she was going to keep up with her new duties as vice president. How had it happened? She concentrated extremely carefully while it was going on, but it had all happened so fast that she still could not precisely say how it had happened, except that she'd arrived at the office with the dog breathing on her heels, and something about her, costume, manner, the dog, had prompted Marianne to pass her on into the boss's office without an appointment, and in spite of the fact that the softness group was there for the second in a series of major meetings on the merger she'd been slated to mastermind before the breakup with Alex had left her on the rocks. What had she said exactly? She did not know. All she could remember were the looks on the faces of the group in the room as she and the dog of truth swarmed into the meeting like warriors taking a fallen city, and the fact that in a few suave sentences, perhaps abetted by the dog whose presence prompted the others to say things they thought secretly but never intended to reveal, she had turned the meeting around and brought the softness group into the company fold like so many grateful sheep. Yes, it was wonderful. She took the dog of truth to dinner at the Indian Oven as a special thank you treat. Meanwhile, there were big doings with Alex. He wanted to come over. He called up out of a clear sky and begged. Really, Alex, I'm tied up tonight. Even with her back turned, she knew what color those green eyes were turning. I mean, I don't know if I want to see you. I mean, I want to see you, but I don't know how to handle it. So here they were, she and the dog of truth, which seemed to have been sent by her mother, a doubtful boon. In less than 24 hours, everything had changed. She knew she ought to be more grateful, but still. Alex would be here at 10. It occurred to her that it might be a wise precaution to put her new pet to bed before he came. "Don't mind me," it said. "Chances are he won't even be able to see me." She gave it a stern look. "I just bought you a fabulous dinner, and I have furthermore entertained your every little thought on life and art and truth ever since we met. Of those three, truth is the most important. Don't be didactic." Even so, she couldn't help it. She let it know she was exasperated with it. "Just this once, will you give me a little break?" "All right, all right." She could tell it was sulking. "I'll just go back under this bed." "Not so fast. This is between Alex and me. Just Alex, just me." "That may not be so easy." "Don't be so ridiculous. Now I want you to go in the bathroom and stay in there until I give you the all clear." She decided it would be best to greet Alex in a selection from the evening wear quadrant of her new Dress for Success wardrobe. He, in turn, had chosen to come in his car tinkering ensemble, a fact she did her best to overlook in spite of the fact that the t-shirt was smelly and the shorts were stiff with grease. He said, "You look wonderful," with a little frisson that surprised her because she didn't know what it signaled. She said, "Well, so do you, or I will as soon as I get a shower." It was clear where Alex's mind was running. "No, no, not in there." He looked puzzled. Plumbing problems. Why did this evasion make her feel so uncomfortable? "Let me watch you scrub up. You can use the kitchen sink." "You won't mind?" She said truthfully, "We don't have any choice." How could she explain what had happened to her in the past few days while they were separated? How could she explain to him what strange chain of circumstances had restored the joy to her vivre, the sheen to her hair, and the aspiring executive to her desk? If she showed him the animal, whether or not he could see it, He would think she was crazy. Worse yet, Alex hated pets. He would force some kind of confrontation. "Listen, honey, it's either it or me. You can't light candles in two places." She would insist she kick the creature out. Would that be such a bad thing? She did not know. She knew only that she'd been in a decline until the thing manifested itself, slouched in the very chair where Alex was sitting, wallowing in grief and malamars, and her hair getting greasier and her face beginning to bloat. But since then, and this morning, when she'd finally acknowledged the green glow and nerved herself to confront the thing, her fortunes had changed. She lunged to put herself between Alex and the bathroom, where her strange pet lurked. "Where are you going? I told you the plumbing needs fixing." "My old bathrobe. I left it on the back of the door." She lied desperately. "I threw it out. I'll buy you a new one," she added hastily to make amends. "Velour, if you like, or better yet, raw silk." In time, he let her draw him into the kitchen, where he scrubbed while she went into the bathroom to find some old thing for him to throw on. To her surprise, the dog of truth was not in the bathroom where she had left it. It was curled up in the middle of her queen-sized bed. It said, "I didn't want to inconvenience you. The bathroom's free. I told you to stay put." Why did it answer in her mother's tones? "I won't have you fibbing to protect me." Oh, good grief! She locked the bedroom door on it. When their midnight supper was over, Alex seemed surprised that she drew him over to the day bed instead of going to seal their reconciliation on her Pierre Cardin sheets. "It's cramped here," he said, his knuckles dragged on the floor by the dust ruffle. "Don't be boring. It's romantic. Our problem was we were taking each other for granted." Of course, that had not been the problem. She'd stepped out just once with an old boyfriend from her hometown. In his Punch and Judy fashion, Alex had retaliated before she even had a chance to explain. "It doesn't matter," Alex was breathing into her ear. "You're the only person I've ever really loved." Turned on her side as she was, so she could face him, Amanda was disconcerted by the fact that although they had turned off the lights and closed the shutters, the walls and ceiling glimmered like a glow-in-the-dark frisbee after it's been held close to a lamp. Alex was importuning her. "Now tell me just exactly how much you care for me." She begged the question by burying her face in his hair, to no avail. When she closed her eyes, the inside of her head seemed to be a pale green. "Amanda, speak to me." It was a little hard to do because, in spite of the closed door defying the laws of logic, the dog of truth had escaped the bathroom somehow and stationed itself on the Morris chair, and it was glaring at both of them. She could read its expression. "This man is a rat. He isn't worth it, and you are not telling the truth. You're near the man you love only 'cause you love the man you're near." Was it humming a little? She prayed Alex couldn't hear. Alex was alert now because they had been together for so long, and now they'd made it up, he was once more attuned to her, which meant he turned to see what she was upset about. "What's that?" "I am the dog of truth," it said sententiously, overriding Amanda, who was mumbling. It's kind of hard to explain. But she did explain, as it turned out, as quickly as possible, throwing in all the code words and gestures that develop in a long relationship, even a troubled one, anything to foil the creature which was beginning to get on her nerves. Alex smacked his forehead. "You mean it, the truth," she said. "No matter what?" She sighed. "So it would seem. You know I love you more than anything." The green glow in the room was stronger. "And I love you more than anything, too." She turned her head to protect her eyes from the blinding light. "Then you know what we're going to have to do. Wait a minute, guys." The thing was fizzling like a 4th of July fireworks finale. Rolling off the daybed as one, they bundled up the flowered cover and lunged towards it, muffling it like a parrot that has gotten out of hand. She thought it an interesting coincidence that it was her mother's tones the creatures echoed right before they overpowered it, yelping, "I'm only doing this for your own good." What they finally did with the dog of truth, a solution that seemed more human than less satisfying than waiting a bag and throwing it off a convenient bridge, was to bundle it into the Goodwill Institute's pickup box in the customer parking lot down at the Stop and Shop. As they drove away, she looked back and with a little pang saw its light flickering like the glimmer of an abandoned lightning bug. At least, she thought, it will have a good home. Would she be able to keep her new job without the dog of truth? She did not know. For that matter, would she be able to keep Alex? She was not sure. What she did know was that they couldn't even hope to be happy together with that unearthly thing hanging around with its accusatory eyes, waiting to catch them up on every tiny little mental reservation and flash like the Hatteras light if they tried anything more serious. She stifled creeping, lonely feelings, but could not keep from saying, "I think I'm kind of going to miss it." Alex ran a red light without a second thought, and hale as he was, pulled into a handicapped parking space so he could take her in his arms. "Good riddance," Alex said. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.